The Secrets of Star Trek is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to The Secrets of Star Trek, where we discuss the hidden layers and deeper meanings found in all the Star Trek TV series, movies, and more. And today we're discussing the Next Generation episode I've been waiting for so long. I've been anticipating this day. We're discussing the first season episode, Angel One. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today on the panel are Father Corey Stika. Hey, Father Corey.
The sarcasm is strong with this one.
And Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
Folks, be sure to stick around to the end of the episode. We have your listener feedback that we'll be discussing. And I want to encourage you to remember to like The Secrets of Star Trek on our social media. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. We're on Twitter or X, where we're at SQPN. And be sure to leave us comments wherever you find us. We love to hear from you. And another show on the StarQuest Network that I'm sure you'll enjoy is The Secrets of Middle Earth, which you can find wherever fine podcasts are found, or at sqpn.com/Middle Earth. So, Jimmy, tell us about Angel One.
This week, Captain Picard and the gang go to Angel One, a non-Federation planet that we'll be seeing a lot more of in the future because the background paintings they did for the Angel One city will be recycled in lots of future episodes. The Enterprise is there to search for survivors of a ship called the Odin, which vanished 7 years ago. Angel One is a female-dominated society, so we get lots of awkward role reversal commenting on mid-20th century relations between the sexes. It's sort of like a female version of Mad Men. It turns out that the Odin survivors are there, and they're all men, so they've been upsetting Angel One society by questioning the role of women. Our gang offers to take them home, but they've taken wives and had children and refuse to leave. And since they aren't Starfleet, the Enterprise can't make them leave by force. So the leader of Angel One, Don Draper, Mistress Beata, condemns them to death, which they seem to be okay with. Riker is willing to break the Prime Directive and beam them up anyway, but Dr. Crusher quarantines the ship because there's a plot complication virus striking the crew down. They also need to get to the neutral zone ASAP to add extra drama. Fortunately, Dr. Crusher gets the cure for the virus just in the nick of time, as if there was any doubt about that, and Riker makes a speech about societal evolution, which leads Mistress Beata and her council to commute the death penalty to exile to a remote area for the Odin survivors and their families. The end.
All right, Father Corey, your overall impression of this one?
Oh, this is just a wonderful discussion of the matriarchy versus the patriarchy versus the enlightened Starfleet. And okay, I can't go any further. This is bad. I mean, this is consistently rated as one of the worst episodes of TNG. It is very much a first season episode, and it shows it. It's creaky. But the only thing good about it is you got Patricia McPherson, which those of us who grew up in the 80s remember as Bonnie from Knight Rider. Oh, and admittedly, Troy and Tasha Yar's reaction to
Riker
is a pretty good scene.
Yeah, yeah. That was all of us. That was the audience. Jimmy, how about you?
So I hadn't seen this one in ages and ages and ages, and I've never liked it. And so I was interested that I think it's a little bit better than I remembered it. It's nowhere near as bad as Code of Honor. That's the one with, there will be no vaccine and no Lieutenant Yar. I mean, that one was just horrible. And this one is similar. In that, they did a sort of a race. The thing that's bad about that is they've got an alien culture and everybody is black, and that's okay. I don't have a problem with a planet where people have the same skin tone, you know, and I don't care if it's black. That used to be Earth. Everybody used to be black. You know, if you go back 30,000 years. So I don't care about that. But it's just such a ridiculous alien culture that it plays badly when you do that kind of racial casting. Here we've got a role reversal with the sexes, and it's not based on 1987. sexual relations. It's based on like 1950 sexual relations. And in principle, that's okay. But once again, the execution is terrible. This is a first season episode. The dialogue is incredibly stilted. And there's lots of ham-fisted stuff. And Gene Roddenberry's sexual predilections are all over this. I mean, Mistress Beata, and even though Riker has told Mistress Beata, I'm not here to seduce or be seduced as part of my diplomatic mission, she seduces him. And they pan away with the clear implication they just had relations. And so there's lots of just stupid stuff. The Riker in the weird flouncy man woman costume at one point, you know, and they have all the, so by the way, on this planet, all the women are like tall and somewhat muscular, and they've got these little elfin men running around in, in leotards and stuff.
The soy boys.
So a bunch of soy boys. And so, so there's lots of bad stuff, but they do try to do a few things that are okay. We've got this B plot of the virus of the week that's just there to fill time and add drama. But one thing that's nice about it is this: the way the virus works is, and Crusher has to figure out how it spreads, which should be super easy for her, but takes most of the B plot running time. And it turns out when people are emitting the virus, it has a very pleasant aroma. And so that inspires deep inhalation, which is how you infect yourself. And that's a clever idea. You know, I mean, what happens on Earth is our bodies, when we get a virus or an infection like this, a respiratory infection, is we start trying to sneeze it out. That's why we sneeze and cough. We're expelling the virus. But that's what the virus wants, so it can spread to other people. Well, this is an alternate route for how viruses could spread. You emit a pleasant aroma, and it causes other people to inhale. And that's how it can spread. And so that actually makes sense. I like that. That's nice. Also, I like that because of the sexual attitudes that the people on Angel One have, Yar and Troy get much more to do than they normally do. They have to take lead roles. Riker is kind of put to one side for a good bit, whereas normally he'd be the lead diplomatic guy on the away team. He lets Troy do that, and Yar gets a bunch to do. And so I like the fact that they have more agency and more activity. I like that. I also like that for most of the episode, the Angel One people have a rationale for their view of sexual relations. Now, because this is Starfleet and because this is written by humans, it's an unstated assumption that no sex is actually different from the others, really, in any meaningful way. But this is an alien species. They could be entirely correct about how male and female work in their species, because it's not the same in every species. A male black widow spider and a female black widow spider are very different. And so the idea that there are differences between the sexes, even if we value them equally, the idea that there are differences between the sexes is not wrong. Yes. And when you look at an alien species, they could be a mirror image of us. And so their system may be entirely rational. And the women in the Angel One Society, because Mr. Spiata talks to Riker about this, has a coherent explanation for why they treat their men the way they do. Yes, it's a little matronizing from a human perspective, but it's not unreasonable. They're not just dogmatic about it. And she tries to convey to Riker the idea, we really care about men. We want them to live life to the fullest, and that's why we do this and this and this. And I like that they allow that perspective, which is really a mirror image of a human patriarchal perspective. I like that they explore that and let it have a voice instead of just saying men are born to be dominated, you know, which frankly a lot of human cultures would have said about women, you know, it's, oh, just a woman that don't really have to care about, you know, you go to some some human cultures, and they're actually like that. Not here in the West, but some of them are. And so I like that they had some reflection on that part. And I also like that the Federation has to treat them with respect. They don't just get to lecture the Angel One people about how bad their system is. They are required by their cultural sensitivity ideals to say, this is their system. We don't have to like it, but it's theirs and we have to respect it. And I like that the episode takes that seriously, because if you are doing actual intercultural contact, you can't just lecture the people in the other culture. Mm-hmm. You have to treat them with respect, even if their system is totally different than yours, and even if you don't like it at all. So I have actually found myself appreciating those aspects of Angel One, even if everything else is horribly incompetently done.
So from my impression of this one, my overall, I still didn't like it. But mm-hmm. My impression was this is a mid-1980s exploration of misogyny flipped on its head, directed and written by a bunch of dudes. So, you know, that no women were involved in the actual creation of this story exploring misogyny from a alternate perspective. Although it does turn out that the writer, Patrick Barry, never intended it to be as much of a misogyny exploration. He wanted to make something that was more an exploration of apartheid, which was very current in the mid-80s. That was in South Africa, which was how white people treated the black population horribly. And so,
white people, white South Africans treated black South Africans.
Right. In South Africa. That's what I meant. In South Africa. The white people treated the black people horribly there. And,
my point is, it's not all white people and it's not all black people. These white people treated these black people badly.
In South Africa. Yes. That's my point. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Roddenberry got his hands on it and really,
sexed
as you mentioned. Yeah. As we saw the roots of this in the original series in the 60s, by this point in the 80s, Roddenberry was, unleashed. And I feel like, I haven't read deeply into the behind the stuff, the scene stuff, but this must be about when Roddenberry's influence on the show was starting to be pried out of his hands, because Barry was the writer was really upset with the result. He hated the end result of this.
I mean, this was first season, so but you have to wonder if by the time this came or by the time this was being produced, the early episodes were already starting to come out and people are starting to see the reaction. But it's obviously by second season, they start pulling away from him. And then the third season, wasn't it after the fourth season that he passed?
Something like that. His influence dramatically diminished between the first and the third seasons.
Yeah.
And partly that was his health. Partly that was the fact he was drunk all day because he would be walking around with a can of Coke and he didn't have Coke in his can of Coke.
Yeah.
And also people just were not willing to live with his predilections on everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. And yeah, so, you could see that conflict between the writer and the producer showed up on screen. Let's put it that way. I was kind of like taking it back. I take what you said, Jimmy, about how other species even on Earth, there are the species where the female is much larger and aggressive than the male and that sort of thing. And so I think that, but in this, the female, they all looked very human. And so the females, though, are larger and more aggressive, more testosterone than the men.
Yeah. The men are just so funny to me in their little elf costumes. One of them, even Trent, the Mistress Beata's assistant, he's even got a little metal pointed ear thing.
Yes.
He just looks so elfin.
They probably found like the shortest actor they could in Hollywood to play that role.
I was like getting secondary embarrassment for the guys, the actors, what it must have been like to be on set to be, hey, why don't you come on set and be weak, feminized male for this show? Okay. Not great for my reputation, but it was annoying that like all the men were sort of weak, less intelligent, apparently. It sort of implies that you know, from the production standpoint, that men view women as weaker and less intelligent, which is,
well, that was a stereotype.
Yeah.
Also, despite the fact that the men on this planet are supposed to be weak and more feminine and stuff, they let them be executioners.
Yeah.
You know, when they're going to execute, what's his name? Ramsey. Yeah. When they're going to execute Ramsey, they've got this disintegrator machine they're going to use, and they like disintegrate a big vase just to show us how it works. And Trent, the elfin, little elfin assistant, is the executioner. He's the one. He's got this glow. He's got this crystal thing. He puts his hand down on the crystal and it activates the disintegrator. He disintegrates the vase, and then they put Ramsey in the thing, and Trent's hand is coming down. And I just like, wow, this is like having the office secretary be your executioner.
Yeah. I've known some office secretaries that's
oh yeah.
Yeah, but it's not the stereotype.
No, no. Well, I thought it was amusing that the electric chair for this society is stored conveniently out the doors of the parliamentary chamber. Like it's there the whole time. Like, what kind of message are we sending to our people that way in this society? Yeah. That was kind of weird. So logical holes throughout the story. Things like we're told the last Federation ship showed up 60 years ago. That's the last time a Federation ship intentionally visited this planet. But the Federation Council insists on maintaining good relations. What relations?
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't make logical sense.
And there's no warp technology, so this actually, you know, Prime Directive should apply even if they visited before.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's one of my notes is, why doesn't the Prime Directive apply at all in this case? That was weird. Also, they're continuing to do that kind of silly Data thing where Data doesn't know very obvious things that he would download from Wikipedia.
Like, I know.
We get to have this awful cringy scene of trying to explain to Data what an aphrodisiac is.
Yeah, he does not know at the beginning of this episode what perfume is.
Yes. Yeah.
And then they explain it to him as, well, some people use it as an aphrodisiac, and he doesn't know what an aphrodisiac is. And it's like, surely my web browser knows, it's got an internal dictionary. It knows what perfume and aphrodisiacs are. Data should be as smart as my web browser.
No, I can see him not being familiar with the little mister, the classic perfume mister. I could see that.
But then later in the episode, he knows what bingo means.
Right.
Because Crusher gets him on the phone and when she's found the virus cure and says, bingo. And he says, the game. So he knows what bingo is, but he doesn't know what perfume is.
He was disconnected from the Enterprise Wi-Fi while he was on the planet.
That's right. Yeah. It's just like, we know that Data went to the Academy for some period of time. I mean, he's got acquired knowledge and information. It's dumb. It's a bad trope. I'm glad they got rid of it quickly after this point. And it just only serves here to create this cringy moment where Riker and Troy and Tasha have to explain sex stuff to Data, and that's just not funny. It's just
especially kind of since one of them, Data, experienced it firsthand.
Yeah, that's kind of awkward too.
I do like, though, I did think this was funny, where, and I don't know how intentionally it was meant to be funny, but you know, Data has the perfume atomizer and he puts it down on the desk in the room on the planet. And then Trent, the little elf dude, comes in and picks up the atomizer and spritzes himself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I do like Brent Spiner acting like the, you know, picking it up and accidentally spraying himself in the face. And there's a little bit of physical humor there. That was good. So the virus thing, it reminded me a bit of like the Naked Now, where it's the initial transmission is by Snow, the Snow from the holodeck.
Maybe. I think they were pretty unclear.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I found it an unnecessary dramatic tangle, like a B plot that just didn't really matter in the end.
It gave them the why can't we beam everybody up excuse. Yeah. I mean, that's literally all it was there for. Oh, and then, of course, the ticking clock of, you know, Data saying, well, we've got exactly 41 now before we can leave, or 48 and then 47. That's what it was. You know, so they got that little ticking clock there that they got this all, get this all resolved in 45 minutes or less.
Well, there are other ways you could have given a ticking clock. But yeah, I agree. But the thing that got me was Crusher saying, as you said, Jimmy, she figures out that it's transmitted by the sweet smell that people inhale deeply. Except in the beginning, she says, I've ruled out person to person contact.
I assume that means like touch.
I guess, but the doctor would, you know, usually respiratory ailments are transmitted by
air.
Breath. Yeah. That would be the first thing you'd check is there a virus load in their breath or their mucus or whatever. It did remind me, as any of us alive in 2024 now thinks about it, it did remind me of that 2020 COVID incident where the USS Theodore Roosevelt aircraft carrier was disabled by COVID. I don't know if you guys remember that out in the Pacific. So there was kind of a little flashback of that one.
The science on that was she needs to figure out the method of transmission in order to crack the virus. That's ridiculous. You need the virus in its genetic code.
Yep. Yeah.
And you can find that without knowing how it's transmitted.
Right.
So, you know, the science on all that was stupid. I did like, there is a nice exchange. Now, by the way, Captain Picard's a terrible patient.
Yeah.
And Dr. Crusher is delinquent in her responsibilities as chief medical officer because Picard has gotten infected and he's soldiering on and refuses to give up command of the Enterprise, even when he's clearly very sick to the point he's staying in his ready room in his cabin and leaving the bridge to Geordi, which that in itself is okay. Geordi's functioning as the watch officer, but the reason Picard's doing this is because he's so sick and Crusher comes and diagnoses him and says, in my medical opinion, you're not fit to run the Enterprise right now. Then relieve him of command immediately. If he's not taking your advice and getting bed rest, if he's genuinely unqualified to run the ship right now, take him out of the chain of command.
And bring back the first officer from his mission. Let Troy and Tasha and Data do the job, they're apparently doing, and give him a mask rebreather, which they probably have as a really good technology in the 24th century. Oh my gosh, it's so many logical holes.
Or a hazmat suit. We know they've got spacesuits.
Right.
Beam him down a spacesuit, have him put him on, beam him back up. Or do what they eventually did and just beam Data up and give him command.
Right.
But having said all that, there is one exchange I like in this whole B plot, which is early on, Worf and Geordi are on the bridge, and Worf says, I think I may sneeze. And LaForge says, a Klingon sneeze? And Worf says, only kind I know.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, and then he does sneeze, and Geordi makes a remark like, I think they've heard that. They heard that one down in engineering.
Yeah.
As someone who has loud sneezes, I know how he feels.
And eventually, LaForge orders him to sickbay, and just as that's happening, this is another nice little bit, just as Worf is leaving to go to the elevator to go to sickbay, a new message request comes in from engineering about some problem that needs to be solved. And even though Geordi's not an engineer yet, he's clearly on that path. He knows about engineering, and he's like, okay, I'll be right there. And Worf stops and turns around and says, Geordi, there are other people to do this. Mm-hmm. And Geordi realizes, oh, yeah, I'm in command. So, okay, go get Lieutenant so-and-so, and she'll take care of it.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's a growth moment for Geordi as a character, and he thanks Worf for the advice. And that's a nice little moment.
That's good. That's good. So you mentioned, Jimmy, the Riker's native costume, which we all get to laugh at him wearing, because it is ridiculous. It is silly.
He does point out correctly that, you know, when I was on this planet, I wore feathers, and when I was on this planet, I wore furs, so this is just more of the same. And in principle, that's true. You know, if you watch, like, World Leaders, when you get the G8 getting together or whatever, they dress in the native costume of whatever country they're in, you know. So like you see them in Thailand or something, and you'll see the president of the United States wearing a Thai robe. And that's a way of showing respect for, as well as the, you know, prime minister of England and all these other people are all wearing the local costume. And that's all fine. And that's true. It's just, in this case, it looks stupid.
Yeah.
And we do get to laugh at him along with Tasha and Troy. I feel like if I was trying to make a rank of the cringiest moments in the episode, it was that one where, Riker is meeting with Mistress Beata and she requires him to stay behind after the meeting,
quote unquote.
Yeah. I mean, it just was so obvious, so ugh. Like,
yeah.
And like, if it was a male, if this was Voyager and it was Janeway and it was, it would, nobody would buy it. Nobody would go for it. It would be gross.
Speaking off the parliamentary chambers, her bedroom is right off the parliamentary chambers through a gauzy veil.
It's like, yes.
It's yeah, like that, that's mini- not awkward or anything.
It's like a miniature White House.
Yeah. I was going to say the Bill
Clinton. And they actually give Riker the line. To me, this is one of the cringiest moments in the episodes where, as she's seducing him, he literally asks her, but will you still respect me in the morning?
Yep.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, wow.
I don't respect you right now, Will Riker. Or Jonathan Frakes for delivering that line.
Now, there's no way this episode is reflective enough to really consider this. But actually, he's engaging in an act of diplomacy here. And so in order to be qualified for that, he would have been given diplomatic training.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually would have to consider things like this, because reproductive stuff does get involved in diplomacy, like political marriages, for example, to unite houses and, exchanging children. And stuff like that. I mean, even humans have reproductive stuff going on in connection with forging alliances and diplomacy and stuff. And so they would, who knows what an alien race is going to have in that regard. If you read Larry Niven's Ringworld series, on the Ringworld, the standard thing when you have two groups meet up and they want to establish social relations is they have what's called Rishathra, which is sexual relations. And it's like a prelude to diplomacy. And one can even see the logic that would be involved in that, because when we engage in reproductive behavior, it is distracting from other, and this is true across species, when at least among mammals and birds and reptiles, it's maybe a little different for fish, but among mammals and birds and reptiles, if you're engaging in reproductive behavior, you are distracted and you are vulnerable. And so by getting vulnerable and doing something that involves pleasure with members of another group, you're showing goodwill and trustworthiness. It's kind of like you meet them for a cocktail hour and you get drunk together as a preliminary. You're getting vulnerable. You're expressing pleasure. So you could have an alien culture where Rishathra would be part of the diplomatic process. And that's something that Starfleet would have to think about in real life, but somehow Will Riker doesn't seem to be overly competent in that area of figuring things out.
He went to the Kirk School of Diplomacy.
And there would have to be considerations of, like, if you're a Starfleet officer and you're a diplomat and this is against your moral code, how do you deal with that?
Yeah.
How do you say no in a diplomatic way? You presumably explain, in my culture, this is what we do instead. So why don't we do it in my culture's way now and not have the sex? And then we'll do something else in your culture's way, and we'll both be mutually respecting each other's cultures.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. That would have been nice and refreshing. Mm-hmm. Later on, Data has to tell Troy and Tasha that the Odin crew can't be made to leave because they aren't Starfleet, which seems like a kind of a weird explanation. Like, either Tasha and Troy should know that, or it's a dumb limitation. Yeah.
Like, it's exposition for the sake of the audience. What's more problematic is that they think, though they're not Starfleet, so they're not bound by the Prime Directive. Okay, I'm pretty sure the Prime Directive is not just a fleet regulation, because it's so important.
Yeah.
You don't want your military operating under this severe restriction and let your civilians do anything they want. I mean, here in the United States, for example, we have technology transfer restrictions that don't just apply to the military. They apply to civilian corporations.
Right.
So you can't just give your highest advanced tech over to China or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, I think the Prime Directive is considered a Starfleet directive. It is not a Federation directive.
Oh, no.
Because, for example, in U.S. CENTCOM, U.S. Central Command, there's General Order 1, which is no alcohol. I mean, among other things, but nothing that is considered illegal in countries like Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
That is only impinging on military members. You know, civilians can go there, and if, you know, they can get the alcohol in, that's a whole, they're at the mercy of the Saudis at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But the government does not say no.
Yeah. I think you're making a good point, though, that logically, whether this is the in story or not, logically, the Prime Directive should apply to everyone in the Federation, not just the Starfleet.
And I don't disagree with that, but it isn't.
Well, as I've been trying to say, I agree that General Order Number 1 is a Starfleet regulation. What I'm saying in addition to that is that there ought to be some kind of legislation that applies to tampering with other cultures, that applies to civilians. Just like in America, we have anti-sedition acts.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain things that civilians cannot do either with foreign countries.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's examples of where they apply the Prime Directive to non-Starfleet members. You know, where
probably.
Yeah, I'm trying to. I nothing comes to mind though. But yeah, it would
maybe that episode with Worf's brother.
Yeah.
Where he's breaking the Prime Directive to help these people survive.
Yeah. Yep. The other thing, another logical plot hole is it's not believable that the prisoners would choose death for themselves and their families rather than just leave.
Yep.
I don't buy that motivation for a second. No, we are standing firm. Well, you'll be dead in 24 hours. So I guess that's gonna be great for you.
I mean, I don't know if it's so much a plot hole as it's just poorly expressed, because, of course, Riker then makes the point, if you kill them, they're martyrs. And that's basically what they're saying, you know, even if they're not effective, even if it's written very ham-fistedly, that's basically what they're saying. It's not really a plot hole, in my opinion.
And then we've got this speech at the end with Riker going on about what you're dealing with here is not revolution, it's evolution. And, you know, he cites and some off-screen unsettlement that we never really saw of there's already a movement towards men's rights on this and some kind of realignment of sexual relations. There's already some kind of movement in nascent form on Angel One. And then he slaps the idea of this is evolution as opposed to a societal trend. And he's fundamentally misconceiving of evolution in a social Darwinist way, where evolution is not just adaptation to changing circumstances. It's like a force with a direction, you know, towards greater complexity or greater intelligence or greater enlightenment or something like that. And that is not how evolution works at all. Evolution is just the adaptation of organisms to changing environments. It has no direction. And so he's kind of importing this 19th century progress idea, where progress was idealized and viewed as an unstoppable force, which is also one of the things in communism, which is a 19th century progress movement, that he's importing here, and has nothing to do with science. So the science nerd in me is unhappy with the final speech, but they could have saved it by just revising it a bit and saying, you've already got a movement like this. They may be hastening it, but you're not going to be able to deal with it by killing them. And that's going to turn them into martyrs and accelerate this movement. And that part of the speech would have been totally fine. It's just adding evolution onto it that is lame. Also lame is Mistress Beata's reference to Ramsey and his followers' heretical teachings.
Mm.
And we're never told what they are. I mean, number one, they've never established a religion on this planet. So what's heresy in this context? It's just a nasty word to throw around that doesn't have any real meaning in this context. Whereas in reality, heresy does mean something and something very specific. But we're not even told what Ramsey's been telling people. We know that he's in some way been unsettling sexual relations or relations between the sexes on this planet, but we don't know how. They could at least say he's advocating men's equality or men having the right to vote or something like that.
They kind of do, but again, this is just, you know, the weak, ham-fisted writing where she talks about how the, you know, the, it's against the natural order.
Yeah,
what Ramsey does that mean? Is promoting against the natural order. And it is. It's, you know, men are equal to women, and you know all these kind of things. They don't view it that way there. You know, they're the same as women, and all, and should be treated the same as women, and all that.
Yeah, it does. But
they need to spell it out, though. We need to know what it is exactly that he's saying, so we can evaluate.
Is he out advocating? Is he out, you know, drumming up support for his point of view, or is it just by merely existing? Are they undermining society? They don't tell us. Then that's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, it's ham-fisted writing. I mean, that's one of the biggest problems of this. And who knows? Maybe the original draft was so much better till Roddenberry got his grubby mitts on it. But, you know, it's stuff like that where, you know, political heresy and political evolution, not scientific evolution and religious heresy, you know, just things like that where they could be so much more explicit with very simple fixes, and that maybe were there in the first place.
Also, there's another aspect that would add, whichever way they chose to play it, it would add a lot if they weren't being this ham-fisted. Tell us what Trent thinks about all this.
Hmm.
You know, is Trent secretly hoping Ramsey succeeds?
Yeah.
Or is Trent really believe that as a man, he needs to be taken care of and sheltered and things like that? I mean, this is like having a drama about feminism where you don't get the woman's viewpoint.
It's true.
You know? Well, it's like, well, tell us what Trent thinks.
Well, I mean, he did look upset a little bit when Riker and Beata were getting it on. So, I mean,
that was jealousy.
Yeah, exactly. Jealousy. Yeah. I was thinking during Riker's speech, like, why isn't Tasha or Troy give? Wouldn't it be more effective coming from another woman? Like, we start off this episode with Riker turning over control to, you know, Troy. And then for the rest of the thing, he's the one who's running everything. Like, he just takes the reins back, and he's now, you know, in charge of everything again. And it just, that seemed like, are you turning over to Troy or not?
Well, I think that, I mean, again, they could fix this on the dialogue level, but he was using Troy as an icebreaker, you know?
Yeah.
And then once the ice has been broken, he can kind of step forward and assume his normal role.
Yeah. So one last thing I wanted to mention was I saw that I mentioned on the wiki for the Memory Alpha wiki, James Hunt of the Den of Geek, which is a website all about geek stuff, said of this episode, it was not as bad as Code of Honor, but that it contained, quote, almost every terrible cliche seen in TNG's first season in one episode, and then says, we've seen all of this before. And it was barely interesting the first time around. The second time, it's just tedious. A horrible episode on so many levels. So, yeah, I agree with him on that. So, any other thoughts on this episode, Father Corey?
Glad it's done.
Moving on to the next one. How about you, Jimmy?
Oh, one thing. So, we haven't really touched too much on the fact that at the end of the episode, Riker is willing to break the Prime Directive and break Federation law. Data actually tells him several laws are involved, which is believable. And just beam Ramsey and his followers and their families away. And he's running right up on the ticking clock to do that, because as the execution is being debated, you know, you've got Data up on the ship. He's running the ship now. Geordi's too sick, and so he's been relieved. Dr. Crusher's looking for the virus. We only have X number of minutes before we have to leave for the neutral zone. And Riker tells Data to stand by and be ready to transport if this thing goes south on us. And Data just agrees. And Riker said he's willing to be court-martialed over this. So that's, okay, that's interesting. But he's just given Data an illegal order. Father Corey, in the United States military, what do you do if someone gives you an illegal order?
Sir, I cannot fulfill that illegal order.
Yeah, and Data doesn't do that. So I know they're just being sloppy, and they're not focusing on how this works in the real world, but I'm pretty sure as ethical as Starfleet wants to be, if someone in Starfleet gives you an illegal order, you are totally within your rights and, in fact, duty to say no. And they don't address that at all. And that would have been great If, yeah. I mean, that would be a wonderful moment of character conflict. If Data says, sir, I'm not able to fulfill that order.
Yep.
And box in Riker, and then there's no out if Mistress Beata doesn't commute their sentence or something.
I found it, a little bit beyond belief that there would be a law against, it would be a violation of the Prime Directive to beam these people out against their will in the face of execution. Because Beata was willing to let them go. If they left the planet, fine, we're done with them. But there's somehow some law against beaming people out against their will, even though they're probably going to be executed if they don't go.
And I could see that not, it wouldn't be Prime Directive, but it would be, some other rule that, basically against kidnapping. It would effectively be kidnapping if they don't want to go, even if, the legal authority has said, if they leave the planet right now, they go in exile, we'll forget it ever happened. But they say we don't want to go. Well, that would still be kidnapping because the people who are involved had made the free choice not to go. So I can see that. Mm-hmm. I can absolutely see that. So that's the one of the few parts of this episode that just there's no problem there.
Yeah. Even with death on the line, because I'm pretty sure, given Gene Roddenberry's secular humanist vision, I'm pretty sure that the Federation would have have right to die laws. And being able to choose the own form of your death. Now, those would be immoral, but that's not going to stop Gene Roddenberry. So I would bet that the Federation has right to die laws that would protect people's decision to stay even if they're going to be executed.
Now, if this were a different era of Star Trek, it would be interesting to see them pulling these people out against their will and then Riker going on trial, a la Number One in Strange New Worlds, the most recent season, for... Mm-hmm. Going on trial for breaking the law to do the right thing. That would be interesting, but that's not the year of Star Trek we're in. Excellent. All right. So that does it for our discussion of Angel One. And we do have that feedback that we mentioned. Both of these. Well, the first one comes from our discussion of the TNG episode Booby Trap. It comes from Tom on our Discord, who wrote, one of my issues with the Booby Trap episode is where is the rest of engineering? It makes it look like Geordi's the only engineer available. I thought Jimmy Dom or Father Corey were going to reference the Apollo 13 movie where they give a room of engineers a task to figure out how to make a CO2 filter. In this case, why is Geordi the only one working on this problem when there should be other engineers who should be involved?
Well, so I didn't reference Apollo 13 because I didn't think of it, and I didn't think of it because I've only seen it once because I hated it. In order to make Tom Hanks, all-American hero, the center of the film, they have to falsify history and make the other two astronauts who are on that mission look like weakling chumps. And so they're falsifying the historical record in order to make Tom Hanks look like an all-American hero. And when so I just hated that movie. Well,
to be fair to that movie, it's because Jim Lovell, who wrote the original book, was a character that Tom Hanks played. So it was Jim Lovell making himself look like the all-American hero.
I think this was introduced at the script level, but
I seem to recall it came from the book.
In any event, also the real reason that we don't have that happening here is they want all that time to go to Leah Brahms.
That's right.
If they had Geordi talking to other consultants, why do you need Leah Brahms in the episode?
Exactly.
That's one thing I think they eventually do better at in TNG is in later seasons. So you'll see Geordi standing around that little center console in engineering, and they're talking about the issue and sending his crew off and do things.
Like just Barkley.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. So our next feedback comes from Bennett on Facebook, who says, I saw this question asked elsewhere, and I wonder if you had an answer. What, if anything, leaves you feeling emotional from a scene in Star Trek? So emotional as in, well, that's an interesting question. What do you mean by emotional? Is it happy emotions, sad emotions, any emotions?
Nauseous.
So in my case, now I experienced a lot of emotions watching Star Trek. And the ones I value most are, wow, that's really cool. When they have a plot twist or something. There are moments which I find funny. There are moments which I find horrifying. There are moments where I want to cheer. Like there's that great scene in the last 10 episodes of Deep Space Nine, where Gul Dukat has been, you know, pretending to be a Bajoran, and he's wormed his way into Kai Wynn's confidence, and mm-hmm. then he reveals that he's a worshiper of the Pah race to him. And she freaks out and slaps him and yells, "Heretic!" Yeah. And it's like, yes! And the audience is cheering on Kai Wynn for once. That heretic needs to be slapped.
Yep.
And it's a great moment, and it just makes me want to cheer. I suspect what Bennett is asking, though, is, are there any moments where I might tear up? Mm-hmm. And I can't say no, I just can't think of any. What I can tell you is what makes me tear up in other situations.
Right.
What really can cause that is if I see a symbolic death and resurrection. This is something, after my wife died, I discovered that if I see not a literal death and resurrection, but if it's masked, so I just feel the emotions, a symbolic death and resurrection will cause me to tear up. An example of that is the end of the first Toy Story movie. Mm-hmm. At the end of the first Toy Story movie, the family is moving away in the moving van, and Woody and Buzz have been left behind. And they try using like a roller skate and a firecracker to catch up, and there is this moment where Woody is like has gotten up to the end of the moving van and is holding on via Slinky Dog, and they're trying to get Woody and Buzz and the it's not a roller skate, it's like a hot rod toy car. They're trying to get them all back onto the moving van so they can all go with the family, and Slinky Dog is just stretched to the limit and cannot hold on. And let's go. That's a symbolic death. These characters on a narrative level are now dead to the family. But then they use the firecracker, and Buzz Lightyear gets to do Falling with Style and gets him and Buzz and gets him and Woody and the toy car back with the family. That's a symbolic resurrection. And when I can, after my wife's death, when I would see symbolic death and resurrections where I'm approaching this with the emotions, but not dead on cognitively, it would affect me on an emotional level that would cause me to tear up. In fact, I almost teared up several times just relating that story just now. And so whenever I see a symbolic death and resurrection, it can really be a gut punch that can cause me to tear up. And I can't say that I've never experienced that in Star Trek. There very well may, I mean, I've seen hundreds and hundreds of hours of Star Trek. There may well have been incidents like that in all the Star Trek I've seen. It's just not coming to memory.
You know, I can't pick out any particular moment either. You know, it's Star Trek, unfortunately, isn't, you know, the average Star Trek, the average episode of Star Trek isn't really written with strong emotional draw.
Yeah.
I mean, even movies, there really isn't the strong emotional draw. I mean, yeah, you can look at some of, you know, when Kirk's son is killed, you know, that's an emotional moment, and that can be.
Or Spock's death.
In Wrath Spock's of Khan. Death, obviously.
That's pretty close.
That's, you know, I mean, an amazing scene, and that probably is one of the closest for emotional. Interestingly, actually, we recently talked on Secrets of Stargate, promotion, about the episode Heroes, the two-part episode Heroes, season 7 episode where Dr. Janet Frazier dies.
Spoilers.
And that is, well,
it's 20 years ago.
20-year-old episode. Nah, yeah, know, sorry. Spoiler season's over for that episode. And that is an emotional moment. I knew it was coming. I knew the scene was coming where you see it, because you see it on a videotape. You don't see the actual death. You see a recording from Dr. Jackson of the death, and it's still immediately the tears. You know, you could just feel the eyes watering because it's such a shock and such a quick death, you know, but there really aren't a lot of moments like that. You know, of course, those are the moments you joke about. It's getting a little dusty in here, you know, and kind of wiping the tear. But that's probably the best example for me of one of those moments that at least that I can't recall of one like that in Star Trek, other than you like mentioned, you know, the death of Spock, perhaps.
For me, well, I'm Sicilian, so all the emotions are like just below the surface at all times. So.
But you repress them because you followed the ways of Surak.
Exactly. Yeah. Otherwise, I'd be tearing things apart all the time. But for me, no, you guys hit it. Actually, I could tell you the exact line that always brings a tear to my eye and it makes me the most emotional. It's when Kirk says in his eulogy of Spock, he was, of all the souls I've known, I get the chills even just thinking of it. He was the most human. And when Shatner delivers the line, he chokes up as he delivers it. And that always, always gets me. And it's those very human relational moments where people have suffered a loss in whatever entertainment I'm watching. And I see it in them, you know, that really gets to me, you know, like those moment of the loss, recognition, when the people are dealing with what they've lost. It's not even just the moment of the death when Spock dies. I mean, that's, you know, a big deal, but it's when the people who are left behind are shown dealing with their grief. The grief is what gets me. That I would say if I were the most emotional moment in Star Trek for me, that would be that line. But I remember watching The Inner Light, which we've been talking about a few times recently, and getting sort of emotional about that. I wasn't crying, but it was very moving to me to see it. The first time I watched it, to see Picard at the end of that episode and how he was affected by the experience. And it was very moving to me to see that a great acting job by Patrick Stewart in that one. So that would be for me, I guess.
In my case, living alongside the memory of William Shatner saying that line at the end of Star Trek II, I also have a YouTube interview of Leonard Nimoy making light of that moment and imitating William Shatner about the most human.
That's good. Well, what was that? Speaking of Star Trek like things, Galaxy Quest was there was a scene where Tim Allen needed to take a break and go back to his trailer because he was so emotional from the scene. Mm-hmm. And Alan Rickman says, "Oh my gosh, he's experiencing acting."
Galaxy Quest is another one that has like a symbolic death and resurrection in it that can affect me, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. And we've discussed Galaxy Quest on this one, guys, as the best Star Trek movie. That was
by a considerable margin.
But yes. Well, thank you, Ben, for that interesting question and led to a good discussion. So we really appreciate that. So now we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Star Trek, including Justin S., Daniel S., David P., and Father Burke M. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue the Secrets of Star Trek and all the shows at StarQuest, and you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. And we'd also like to thank Victor Lambs, who edited the episode. So that's it from us. What did you think of Angel One? You can let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com/trek, our Facebook page at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, send an email to trek@sqpn.com, or visit our Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord. Or you could watch The Secrets of Star Trek on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/StarQuestMedia and leave us a comment there. We'll be back next time when we'll be discussing the Deep Space Nine episode, If Wishes Were Horses.
Then beggars would ride?
Apparently. Until then, Father Corey Stika, thank you for joining me in sharing the secrets of Star Trek.
Thank you, Don.
Jimmy Akin, thank you as well.
Thank you, and live long and prosper.
And once again, I'm Don Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to the Secrets of Star Trek on StarQuest. And remember, for a man, I can be very clever.